Good evening. Welcome everybody here tonight. We are just started in our study of Deuteronomy. We're still kind of going over our general overview of the book before we kind of dive into it and go through it. Not quite verse by verse, but doing a general overview. On Sunday, we talked about Deuteronomy being similar to a suzerainty covenant. And I know it's a word that you all went home and thought about all week and practiced pronouncing it. I don't even know if I'm saying it correctly or not. But we talked about the suzerainty covenant was a covenant with maybe a king that had conquered a area or was over another town or a small country. And he would make this covenant with them, and he would say all the good things that he did, and then he would also then tell them all the things that they were supposed to do. And those things were written in a certain kind of form. And we talked about how Deuteronomy takes on that form. So it is, I guess you could say that it would be similar to covenants of that time. Now, there's one thing that's different about Deuteronomy than other suzerainty covenants. And if you can think that Deuteronomy is different because those other covenants or documents are motivated by self-interest. If Lexington goes up and conquers Paris, and we put the people in Paris in subjection to us, we do that because we love the people of Paris, right? Is that why a king would conquer another town or country? It's not, is it? I remember, I think back when I was maybe right out of high school, Iraq invaded a little country called Kuwait, right? They didn't do that because they wanted to help those people. They did that because they wanted what they had, right? And so it was motivated by self-interest. But we see that Deuteronomy, this covenant that God's going to make with the children of Israel, is not motivated by any self-interest that God has, right? It is all to benefit the Israelites. And this should have motivated the Israelites to do what? To be obedient to God, right? And to conform to the covenant that God had laid out for them. And so we see that this should have caused, let's read what I wrote in here. This should have motivated Israel to worship God by loving him with their hearts and remembering all the acts of faithfulness with their devotion and their obedience to God. And so that is where Deuteronomy and other suzerainty covenants, you know, they kind of separate because God is who God, you know, because God is who he is. And there are, if we kind of break down Deuteronomy into some different sections, there's four major, I guess, sections or implications that correspond to the four. There's four implications that correspond to the major sections. The first is the first, you know, chapter 1 through about the middle of chapter 4 is this brief history. And we talked about how this is custom history. It's not all chronological, and it's not as complete as the history that's given us in the book of Exodus, but it is written for a purpose. And that purpose is written so that God's faithfulness to the children of Israel can be displayed, and so they can look at how God has been faithful to them and how they have been, and also how they have failed God or been unfaithful to him. Also, the second part of the book, chapters 5 through 26, which is the bigger part, this is God's laws. And God's laws are not a set of rules that are meant to control the people. Like if you were a king, you would put some rules to control a town. That would be to limit their freedom. But God's laws are, it's an expression of his love so that the Israelites could have better lives and could be blessed by him. We are all sinners. We are all sinners. First of all, and we all need God's laws, because without God's divine laws, we don't have any way to once again to be accepted by God. Also, we talked about this a little bit. The Mosaic laws were given to Israel because he intended them to result in blessings for them. So they weren't meant to limit their freedom, but it was meant so that they could receive blessings. Because if you go, when we read through Deuteronomy, we're going to see that he's going to say, do this and live. Receive these blessings. So these laws weren't to limit them, but so they could receive their blessings. And there was this, if they had followed these laws, it was going to cause two things to happen. One is, they were going to be a holy people, right? That was, if they followed God's laws, they were going to be holy. And also, they were going to create this society, the nation of Israel, that the rest of the world could look to and say, I want to be like that nation. And the third part is chapters 27 and 28. It says, only a love for God will adequately motivate us for obedience. This section talks about how God loves us, and that if the only way we can be motivated to be obedient to God is if we love him back. And the fourth section is chapters 29 through 30. And we see that our obedience to God demonstrates our love for him. Now we'll look at 1 John, the 5th chapter. First John 5 and verse 3. It says, For this is the love of God, that we keep his commandments, and his commandments are not burdensome to us. So this whole idea that us loving God is us keeping his commandments and not a burden to us, but it's something that we want to do, something that we look forward to doing, because we want to please God because we love him. And so that kind of is the conclusion of my, as you recall, I reviewed Deuteronomy two times, since that was my conclusion to the second one. So now let's kind of dive into Deuteronomy and begin with chapter 1, verses 1 through 5. And here we see that this kind of places, I'm trying to keep up with my phone so I know what time it is. As we see, this kind of gives the geographical location. We've talked about this. Where is Israel at this point in time? We've mentioned this a couple of times. They're in the plains of Moab, which is east of the Jordan River, before they have crossed over into the river. And so, if you read there, it talks about them being 11 days' journey from Horeb. And I also read that Horeb is just another word for the area of Mount Sinai. So they're 11 days' journey from Mount Sinai. That was where they were at when they got the law the first time, right? How many years ago was that? See, yeah, I've read 38, 39 years. That's a long ways. I mean, that's a long time to travel 11 days' journey. And we see that we know why that it took that long, because they were disobedient to God, and he punished them and sent them out into the wilderness. So I guess we can see that if you don't follow God's ways, it's going to take you, you know, a long time or even a whole another generation to get there. And I want to read verse 5 just tells where they are. Across the Jordan, the land of Moab, Moses undertook to expound this law, saying, so this kind of tells where they were as Moses began to read this to them and to expound on this. Chapters, now starting in verse 6 all the way through chapter 4, verse 40, is this historical survey. And as we talked about earlier, this is not going to be exactly chronological. It's going to be a little different, maybe a little more general. It causes I guess some people that want it to be exact verbatim of the Exodus account, that bothers them some. But this section is going to highlight God's faithfulness and Israel's disobedience. And if you look at chapter 1, verses 6 through 8, it says, "The Lord our God spoke to us at Horeb, saying, 'You have stayed long enough at this mountain. Turn and set your journey and go to the hill country of the Amorites and to all their neighbors in north, in the Arabah, in the hill country, and in the lowland, and in the Negev, and by the seacoast and the land of Canaanites, Lebanon, as far as the great river Euphrates. See, I have placed before you the land before you. Go and possess the land which the Lord swore to give to your fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, to them and their descendants after them.'" So what's happened is all the generation of the fighting men that refused to enter Canaan have passed away, and God tells them to go and take the land. So has God forgotten the promise that he made to Israel? He hasn't. And so we see here he reveals his purpose to them and tells them to go and take the land. And then we see in this next little section here, verses 9 through 15, that Moses, the history of Moses creating this hierarchy of people to judge the people. If you remember, that was like he set up, you know, over hundreds all the way down to tens. And there was one thing here in verse 16 and 17 that he charges these judges with. He says, "Then I charge your judges at that time, saying, 'Hear the cases between your fellow countrymen and judge righteously between a man and his fellow country or the alien who is with him. You shall not show partiality in judgment. You shall hear the small and the great alike. You shall not fear man, for the judgment is God's. The case that is too hard for you, you shall bring to me, and I will hear it.'" So how does Moses charge these judges? He charged them to judge righteously and fair, right? Isn't that how we expect judges to judge, you know, like in our courts today? Does that always happen? No, it probably doesn't, and I don't know of any specific examples. But we see, why does he charge them, tell them to do it fairly and righteously?
Because he's fair and righteous.
He's a fair and righteous judge. And thinking on that thought, it says here in verse 17, "You shall not fear man, for the judgment is God's." Whenever they would make a judgment, it was like God making a judgment. Now, how can a man judge something and it be as if God had did it? That's the only way. We use God's rules or God's laws, right? Now, I just want to leap forward to our present time. We have, you know, the church has elders. It has, you know, other leaders. Sometimes they have to make judgments about somebody's sin or about different things in the church. How are they to do that? The same way, right? They got to look at God's law and judge it fairly, not show partiality. If, you know, because, you know, this was my cousin in this situation, I'm going to judge this differently than I would any other situation. That's not right, is it? That's showing partiality. Am I going to look at God's law and say, you know, I really don't? That's harsh, right? Have you ever heard anybody say, you know, maybe that, you know, an elder or a congregation made a harsh decision or harsh judgment? If they did it according to God's law, they did it correctly and righteously. And so I think that whenever we make judgments in the church, it has to be done the same way, fairly, righteously, without partiality. Just like we're carrying out God's judgments.
That whole idea of judgment, whether it be harsh or being soft, really is kind of arrogant of us.
Right. It can only be us looking at God's will and going after and follow and doing what God's will says. Right, very good point. Matt?
All of that is, but it's also important to know that the shepherd is not, like, if the elders have to make a decision or do something like that, they need to understand their flock well enough to know this is how I should really approach this with this person. They need to do so in love. They need to try, they need to have the spirit, the evidence. They need to have gone by the way the Bible lays out how to have, you know, address the problem with the brother. But so, all that to say that there is a way to make sure that we go about it the right way, that we don't cause our brother to stumble and not put a stumbling block before them. So we have to, I've heard this used often, to deliver the truth in love, which is kind of saying, let, you know, give them the hard knocks. But there is a very important way to go about it to make sure that we don't cause our brother to stumble when we make those hard calls. Albeit, you know, not necessarily that, not stepping on Eddie's point where the
okay. So the idea that yes, good judgment has to be used. And God kind of lays out in some different passages how we approach somebody that's older or a brother. We approach them like a brother or somebody that would be, if we approach somebody that's older, we approach them like we would approach our father or somebody like our brother. And to have our you know, I can't think of the passage, but to have our, you know, our words seasoned so that they could be effective. And
Ephesians 4,
okay. That's where we don't, it's not like, when I say harsh, I don't mean like coming in and being mean. I mean, if we look at God's law and we don't like something that we see, that's not our judgment to make, is I guess the point I'm trying to make. And then any other comments on that section? And then we see in verses 19 through 46, the history of when the spies were sent into the land. And we all are familiar with this account of how the spies go in and they come back and they give a bad report that they can't take the land, all of them but two, Joshua and Caleb. And I think there's two failures here. The first one is they have this unbelief when they come back that they don't believe they can take the land, right? That's not to say that they obviously believed in God, his existence, because they had just left the mountain where they were scared he was talking to them. So we're not talking about, you know, not believing in God. This lack of faith that they could go in and take the land. And if you look in verse 27, and it says, "And you grumbled in your tents and said, because the Lord hates us, he has brought us out of the land of Egypt to deliver us into the hands of the Amorites to destroy us." This is the idea that they think God hated them because he brought them out to be destroyed. They didn't have faith that God could deliver the Amorites into their hand. And so they were prevented from entering this land because of their unbelief. And they didn't have this faith that God could help get them in. And we're going to see that they had faith in God, right? Remember, they had come out and crossed through the Red Sea. And it says they crossed, if we look in Hebrews, it'll say they crossed through that with faith. So it's not like they didn't have any faith in God, but they got here to this point and things got too hard. It was too scary. And then they were rebuked by Moses, and they come in and they said, and God tells them, "You're not going to enter the land." And so does anybody remember else what they did then? They tried to go and take it on their own, and Moses told them not to, or God through Moses told them not to. And we see that they went, and that was their second failure at this time. They disobeyed God again by going to fighting. So had they repented the first time? They hadn't repented because they're still disobeying God, right? They're still being disobedient. And so we think about how sad this point is for this generation of people. They've seen things that most of the people in the world are never going to see, right? They saw the plagues in Egypt. They saw how God destroyed the Egyptian army in the Red Sea. They saw how God had come and sat down on Mount Sinai, and they saw the smoke and the fire. And so even though they had seen all that, their lack of faith caused them to be destroyed there, or they're going to end up dying in the wilderness. And so beginning in chapter 2, so, you know, it talks about their wandering in the wilderness, and it's going to describe how they approach the land of Canaan. And Adam, he had a really good chart that showed how they came up the land. And remember how, well, first of all, it talks about how all the men who were of fighting age had died in the wilderness. And that's what brings an end to their sojourn. And some of the things I read talked about how this was going to show God's faith, show God's power even more, because all the fighting men had died. And so all these guys were inexperienced. I don't know if I'm quite on board with that, because I'm going to guess the first group, the ones that were slaves in Egypt, weren't trained Navy SEALs either. I'm going to say that they didn't have much idea about how to fight either, but I read that. But anyway, all those men have died. Clearly, the new group is not Navy SEALs either, or the Green Beret, but they're not going to need to be. And to me, there's a couple things here in chapter 2. Look at chapter 2 and verse 5. As they're coming up, he talks about some people here. He says, "Do not provoke them, for I will not give you any of their land, even as a little footstep, because I have given Mount Seir to Esau as a possession." Also in verse 9 it says, "And the Lord said to Moses, do not harass Moab, nor provoke them to war, for I will not give you any of their land as a possession, because I have given Ar to the sons of Lot as a possession." In verse 19 it says, "When you come opposite the sons of Ammon, do not harass them nor provoke them, for I will not give you any of the land of the sons of Ammon as a possession, because I have given it to the sons of Lot as a possession." They come up past these places and he tells them, "You can't take this land." Because why?
Because these are your brothers.
They're your brothers, right? And because God gave them this land. All right. To me, these showing them some examples on the way. You think it's just by happenstance that this is where their lands are and Israel's going to walk right past them? He's showing them an example of this group of people, I gave them a land. This group of people, I gave them this land. What's he been telling Israel he's going to do for them? Give them a land. He's like, you know, it's kind of like, I guess, I don't know if you got your kid and you say, you know, if you do this, then I'll give you this. Look, this is the car that I bought for your sister whenever she did well in school. This is the car I brought for your other sibling when she did well in school. And so to me, it's like he's showing them some examples as he's bringing them up through there of people of how he has kept his promises to them. And so this was, and they received this land because they also were heirs of part of this covenant that God had made with Abraham. And then in chapter 2, 24 through 37, we see that they have this conquest. They come to the first nation that they're going to conquer. And it says the conqueror of Sihon, the Amorite king. And Moses talks about this, and he emphasizes God's faithfulness to them. Do you remember what two things that the spies said about the land, why they couldn't take it whenever they went in? Or at least a couple of things. All right, there were some giants there, right? And he said something about the cities The city had these big fortified walls, right? And it's interesting thing here about this, chapter 2, verse 25. First of all, it says, "This day I will begin to put the dread and the fear of you upon the peoples everywhere under the heavens, who when they hear report of you will tremble and be in anguish because of you." Isn't that how the Israelites felt when they went in and looked at the land? They were fearful, right? They said, "We can't do that. Those people are huge. They have fortified cities." Then in verse 30 it says, "By Sihon the king of Heshbon was not willing for us to pass through his land, for the Lord your God hardened his spirit and made his heart obstinate in order to deliver him into your hand as he is today. The Lord said to me, 'See, I have begun to deliver Sihon and his land over to you. Begin to occupy that you may possess his land.'" So here he comes and he says, he tells them that he's put the fear in them. And he says, and so Sihon hardens his heart, we'll let him pass through. He said, "See, I've always heard to give you the land." Where's the soldiers? All you've done is he's refused, right? I think this shows that, you know, God's power. He said, "I've already begun to do this," the same way he hardened Pharaoh's heart. And then in verse 33, it says, "The Lord our God delivered him over to us, and we defeated him with his sons and all his people." And it talks about how they went in and captured their cities from Aor, which is on the edge of the valley of Ammon, and from the city which is in the valley, even to Gilead. There was no city that was too high for us. The Lord our God delivered all over to us. So here we see these cities had walls, and there was not one that had walls that was too high for them. And so I think that goes against this idea of the walls, you know, being too tall. And then we see that they had these fortified cities in verse 5 of chapter 3. "And these cities were fortified with high walls and gates and bars, besides a great many of unwalled towns." And also, if you get in there and read, this king Og was a giant. His bed was 13 feet long and 6 feet wide and was made of iron. Now, why do you think it had to be made of iron? Probably to hold up that big man, right? Can you imagine somebody needing a bed that's 13 feet long? And so I think, to me, this shows that God is overcoming the things that they were afraid of before they entered the land. And then on down here in chapter 3, we see that God is going to, he divides up some of the land already, and he gives some of the land to Gad and to Reuben, but they weren't going to be able to stay there in their land. Why? Because the rest of the land hadn't been conquered yet, right? And so they agreed to go on in and, you know, help conquer the rest of the land. And I think it was interesting that whenever they left to go in, where were Gad and Reuben as they marched in? We're going to see, I think that they were in the front, right? And Gad and Reuben, that tribes, they kind of led the way. So it's the idea, I think, I don't know if they said, "Well, maybe you have to go first so we can see that you go." But I do think that was interesting that that they went in front. It says, in verse 18, it says, "Then I commanded you at this time, saying, 'The Lord your God has given you this land to possess it. All valiant men shall cross over armed before your brothers, the sons of Israel.'" And so he's commanding them to go on and go in that way. Maybe they couldn't change their mind and go back. But anyway, and then here towards the end, in the chapters 21 through 29, we see that Moses is going to encourage Joshua. In verse 21 here, it says, "I commanded Joshua at that time, saying, 'Your eyes have seen all that the Lord your God has done to these two kings. So the Lord shall do to all the kingdoms into which you are about to cross. Do not fear them, for the Lord your God is the one fighting for you.'" So here he is encouraging Joshua so that he will have this confidence to know that God's the one that's fighting. And this, here in this chapter, we see that Moses, he goes and he pleads with God to let him to enter the land and look around about it and look at it. We see that God refused. And to me, this, I think we talked a little bit whenever Adam was doing Numbers about how maybe that seemed kind of like a harsh judgment from God not to let Moses enter in. But I think what we can take from that is the seriousness of our sin, that how serious God takes our sin. And so God refuses Moses, but we know that he is going to eventually let Moses go up on a mountain to view the land from east of the Jordan River. And so for the Israelites, that puts their history behind them, right? So now we're going to see that they're going to start looking to the future, and Moses is going to start to exhort them. He's going to start to deliver them the law. And so we're going to look here in chapter 4. In verse 1, it says, "Now, O Israel, listen to the statutes and the judgments which I am teaching you to perform, so that you may live and go and take possession of the land which the Lord, the God of your fathers, is giving you." So here he says, listen and obey. Possess this land. You're going to obtain life. And then we see here in verses 5 through 8, it says, "See, I have taught you statutes and judgments, just as the Lord my God commanded you that you should do thus in the land where you are entering to possess it. So keep them and do them, for that is your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of all the peoples who will hear all these statutes and say, 'Surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people.' For what great nation is there that has a God so near to it as the Lord our God, whenever we call on him? Or what great nation is there that has statutes and judgment as righteous as this whole law which I am sitting before you today?" So here we see they're to go and to keep these commandments. And what does this say that other nations should do? I'm sorry? Yeah, they're going to glorify God. It says, in the sight of the people who hear all these statutes and say, "Surely this great nation is wise and understanding people." There was supposed to be this nation that everybody looked to that said, "These people have wise and understanding. Look at the God that they have." I want to compare that to an example of maybe you got the best looking yard in town, right? And people drive by your house and they stop and they say, "What kind of grass seed you put out there, right? What kind of fertilizer do you do? Do you water your yard? How often do you water?" Why do they ask those questions? Just because they would like to know that kind of stuff? It looks different, looks better, and because how do I want mine to look? I want mine to look like yours. They say that's, in business, that's like the biggest form of flattery when somebody copies what you're doing. Because they look at it and they say, what he's doing is better than what I'm doing. And so they were supposed to be this nation. The other people look and says, that nation is better than what we got. And we want to copy that. And we see that was another example I have was, if y'all ever been driving around, you see a cornfield, and they got that little sign there that says maybe DeKalb. Why do you think they put that sign there? So when another farmer drives by and says, "Man, that guy's corn looks good." DeKalb is a seed manufacturer. Next year I'm buying that DeKalb seed. That's the same concept that this Israel was supposed to be. There was supposed to be this nation that we drove by and we say, "Look at that. We're going to start living our lives like they did." And so we see that the other nations there, they had these gods that were inaccessible, right? And the idea that their gods would often be doing something they couldn't get to them. Why do you think their gods were inaccessible? They don't exist, right? It'd be like going knocking on somebody's house and nobody lives there. Nobody's going to come out. That's the reason they were inaccessible. That's why their gods seemed busy or preoccupied. Remember when Elijah was up on the mountain? They thought their God was busy doing something. So they started cutting themselves. But the God of Israel was near to them. How do they know he was near to them? He's been traveling with them, right? The cloud in the daytime and the fire at night. Why was it that their laws and decrees were more righteous than the other nations? Why? Because those laws had been given to them by God. The other nations had been given to them by men. They had made up their own laws. And then if we look in chapter 4, 9 through 14, it says it reminds them not to forget the things that had happened, the things that he was about to teach them. They were to teach them to their children, to their children's children. And then he reminds them about how when they were back at Mount Sinai, how they were afraid and how great and mighty and powerful God was. And so then he goes on in verses 14 through 24, and idolatry is forbidden. And he reminds them, he says, what image did you see when you were at Mount Sinai, basically? Where he says, you saw no image. So they weren't supposed to make any idols. And then he gives them kind of a list of images they're not supposed to make. Isn't that what you got to do with your kids? I don't want you to stop on your way home. Don't stop at the gas station. Don't stop at McDonald's. Don't stop for ice cream. Don't stop at your friend's house. God gives them he says don't make an image, and he gives them a list of things. No shape of a man or woman, any animals, creatures that move on the ground, or fish, the sun, the moon, the stars, heavenly array. Why are all these things, what's significant about all the things in this list?
They're all creations.
They're all created things, right? And that was the temptation of all the other nations. They worshiped the creation rather than worshiping the Creator. They had the Creator to worship. And so he tells them not to make these images and list the different images they weren't supposed to make. And then here at the end of this chapter, Moses brings up his own failure. Good leaders, if you think about our politicians, they all get up there and the first thing they start off with is, this is where I failed, right? That's what they said at the debate, wasn't it? I don't know if y'all watched any of the debates, but they all talk about how they failed, right? No. But we see that Moses reminds them of when he failed. Why would he do that? I'm sorry? So they wouldn't fail, right? It's like whenever you maybe talk to one of your kids or somebody and say, I made this mistake. And I'm telling you this so you don't make this mistake. So he reminds them of when he failed and he was punished for his failure. Remember, his punishment was he was excluded from entering the land. If they fail, what's going to be their punishment? They're going to be excluded from entering the land. And so in this chapter, he reminds them of his failure. Do you think that any of these people here remember the people that were destroyed in the wilderness? I'm sure a lot of them were old enough to remember that. And I know that they were old enough to hear, because if the ground opens up and swallows a whole bunch of people, do people talk about that for a couple of years? Don't do that. A few years ago, God caused the ground to swallow up. And Adam talked about how the plague came forth and the priests would go out and stop it right there. Is that something that you think would have been told? If you saw that? And so we know that they knew that, but Moses reminds them. And then here in 25 through 31, Moses tells them what's going to happen if they turn to idols. He tells them they'll quickly perish from the land. The ones that do live will be carried off to other nations. In those nations, they'll worship gods that are made by man's hands. That's in verse 28. All those other things seem like punishments, right? It's a punishment to be killed. It's a punishment to get carried off into captivity. Why is it a punishment to worship a God made by man's hands. Why would that be a punishment? I'm over here praying to this microphone to, for whatever reason, that's a waste of time, right? That microphone could not help me do anything but talk. And so it's a punishment because if they're worshiping these things, they're getting, it's just a waste of time. They're not getting nothing out of it. But then he tells them, but if they turn and seek the Lord, God would remember his covenant that he had made with them. And I want to read a few verses here. I think this is kind of describing some of the uniqueness of God, beginning in verse 32. It says, indeed, ask now concerning the former days which were before you, since the day that God created man on the earth, and inquire from one end of the heavens to the other. Beginning in what day? The day God created the earth, right? Ask from one end of the heavens to the other. Has anything been done like this great thing, or has anything been heard like it? Has any people heard the voice of God speaking from the midst of the fire as you have heard it and survived? He says, has that ever happened before? Has anybody else ever heard that in history? Whenever they took their history class when they were in Egypt, did they talk about God speaking to them from fire? It never happened before. Or has a God tried to go and take for himself a nation from within another nation by trials and signs and wonders and by war and by a mighty hand, by an outstretched arm and by great terrors, as the Lord your God did for you in Egypt before your eyes? Has that ever happened before? Has any God ever gone and taken another nation out of a nation and was going to take them and give them a land like God did? They knew that that had never happened before. To you it was shown that you might know that the Lord, he is God, there is no other besides him. Out of the heavens he lets you hear his voice to discipline you. And on earth he lets you see his great fire, and you heard his words from the midst of the fire, because he loved your fathers. Therefore he chose their descendants after them, and he personally brought you from Egypt by his great power, driving out from before you nations greater and mightier than you, to bring you in and give you their land for inheritance, as it is today. Know therefore today and take it to your heart that the Lord, he is God in heaven above and on earth below. There is no other. So you shall keep his statutes and his commandments, which I am giving you today, that it may go well with you and with your children after you, and that you may live long on the land which the Lord your God is giving you for all time. So he tells them, you know, look at all these things that God did. It's never even been heard of before. And to me, there's interest as we go and look at the actual Ten Commandments. Whenever it talks about remembering the Sabbath day and to keep it holy, whenever he first gave them that commandment, he said that was so that they could remember. Why was this? What was special about the Sabbath day? It was a day of rest, right? Based on the creation account, which he talks about here. That was one of the things we talked about. And also later in Deuteronomy, he said that it remembered the Sabbath, how they remember how God brought them out of Egypt. That's some of the great, mighty things that God had done for them that they had just seen. And so, if we think about this at their point in history, clearly nothing like this had ever happened before. God had never done anything like this. Now, let's think about it from our place in history. We can look at that and say, yeah, God, we recognize when God brought them out of Egypt, gave them a new land. Do we have record of anything else great or mighty that God has done? I mean, think about the judges, how God conquered people during the judges, right? I mean, there were some things whenever the armies would be up on the hill, they'd go down the next morning, all people would be dead. Anything else great and mighty that might be worth remembering? What about whenever God sent his son here so that we could become a new creature, could be born again, baptized like him. This is just what they're going through, just a preparation for what we have. And God's going to tell them to remember these things, and he's going to tell us to remember that event, right? And so that's just some of the thoughts that I had from that, thinking about that from our point in history. Anybody have any thoughts or comments? I've been kind of, I think, going on and on. All right, we'll look at verses 44 through 49. Here we have kind of a what I'm going to call an introduction to the law. So he restates kind of where they are there, you know, east of the Jordan River. They've said that a lot. And so that's how the chapter 4 ends up. And that gets us over chapter 5, which begins, you know, is like the, I guess, the begins the main part of the law. And there's a little bit of difference between the law in Leviticus and the law in Deuteronomy. The law in Deuteronomy deals a little bit more with how they were to know their daily lives and that kind of thing, where Leviticus has a more of a focus on what the priests were supposed to do. So is that the second bell? All right, we'll begin chapter 5 there on Sunday morning.